علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide for managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 53rd letter of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagha, which he wrote to Malik Ashtar with regards to certain guidelines on issues of leadership. And there we were discussing about certain criteria for a leader to choose people into some sensitive positions. And there Imam Ali alayhi salam says that they should be from good religious households, and they should be people who were earlier in their acceptance to Islam. Like they should have grown, or they should have been for a good period of time into the Islamic system. And then he gives the reasons behind them when he says they should be because they are better or they are more noble in their akhlaq and in their morality. The next one that he says is, he says, وَأَصَّحُ أَعْرَاضًا, that they are purer or they are better in terms of protecting those things that require protection, inshallah. I shall explain what this means.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now Imam Ali alayhi salam says that this group of people that have gone through, that are good and from good households, and they have been for a longer period of time in Islam, these are as-sahhu a'radan. They are sahih. As-sah means those who are very, they are the best, or they are very good, or they are most correct. They are most correct a'radan. In terms of what? In terms of irdh. Now what is irdh? These are certain things that need protection and that are very closely attached to a person. Okay? These are things that are closely attached to a person that normally require protection. Like the type of relationship you have with these things is that you, because of them, their closeness to you, you wish to protect them. Now, ird can include your family, your wife, your children, okay? It can also include your beliefs maybe, but primarily it's mostly used for example, your wife, your children, your own respect and honor, your own, for example, relationship with others also is also included in this. So a person who is asahhu a'radan means the most correct in terms of these issues that need to be protected, means that he not only is careful about protecting his family from negative influences, but also his wife, for example, from negative influences, from being a source of attraction, let's say, for other men or for wrong people. So he's protective about them. He's careful that she doesn't come out of the house without hijab, let's say. She wears hijab. She's careful about the way she interacts. Look, a Muslim man doesn't have to lock her wife in the house, but he has to, even he can allow her to go to work. But when he allows her to do these things, he also has to be careful that she is protected, that she takes the necessary precaution of protection so that she doesn't fall prey to the predatory nature of men. And you know, right now, as you've seen in the West, there's this big issue that women who go to work are facing, that they are always an object of predatory nature of men. Inshallah, we shall discuss this in the coming segment.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, we say that these people who are in a good household and have been Muslims for a longer period of time, they are asahhu a'radan. That means they are more correct in terms of those things that need protection. Which we said one of them is the women in your family. Now, you know, Islam gives such a very beautiful solution to social issues, especially when it comes to women. Islam doesn't negate the ownership of women, that women can own property. Is not against business, that women cannot do business or work. No, Islam says they can. Islam says women can take part in social issues. Islam allows that. But at the same time, because a woman, in the physical sense, has a certain difference from a man, and this is a completely clear difference, psychologically, physically, and in terms of interaction, all of these differences are very clear. I mean, we can't deny them. These are there, psychologically proven and philosophically proven, sociologically accepted. Because of these differences, women are more prone to predatory nature of men. That means they can be affected in a negative way by men. And this is something that you just need to open the news channels and see how many women are being abused in different ways in their workplaces. Just search it up in Google, you'll see it. It's not hidden. Okay, so those people are trying to, you know, kind of, you know, merge these boundaries of men and women, and they're trying to create a different idea. They're just speaking out of whims. But if you look carefully at these things, you'll see that these things are happening. Islam stops that by giving a certain, you know, guidelines to the men that they should be protective about their women in this sense. Their daughters should be covered in a nice way, in an Islamic way, to when they go to study or when they go to work and all of these people. Now, you see, a Muslim who has lived in an Islamic culture and who has grown up in a good household will understand these issues better. And therefore, he is better, you can say, more correct in his understanding with regards to these sensitive issues of protection. And therefore, if he's in a leadership position, he will know how to deal with these individuals in a better way. And the policies that come out and affect the society will be more, you can say, more pure and more valuable towards the people. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
A'udhu billah min ash-shaytani rajim and bismillahir rahmanir rahim. A warm greeting to you brothers and sisters of faith wherever you may be in the world. Welcome to another episode of the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to mention a lot of the questions that you, dear parents, Muslim parents, might have with regards to your teenage children. In the studio, we have Sayyid Salman Naqawi, our expert of the program Islamic Upbringing, who is the faculty member of Islamic Studies in Al-Mustafa International University. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. And we've been talking about the two styles of parenting, namely transformational and transactional parenting. We talked about transformational parenting, 12 the qualities which are empowerment and autonomy. Inshallah, in this program, we will mention two other qualities of transformational parenting. Sayyid, we are all ears.
So, thank you very much. Let's continue with the attributes and qualities of a transformational parent. He, as we said, he empowers his child. He brings out the best in him, gives him, instills in him self-esteem, autonomy, confidence, and as a result, the child becomes competent to do things which are appropriate in the best possible way. And then, how does he deal with the differences of opinion that are there? He imposes, as in the transactional way, it was that he would say, okay, this is my command, you have to do it.
Right.
Even if I listen to you, you have to do it my way. But here, we want the child to do the right thing in the right way, but we need to discuss with him.
Even if it takes a really longer time.
يَعُدُوا عِلَىٰ سَبِيلِ رَبِّكَ بِالْحِكْمَةِ وَالْمَوْعِزَةِ الْحَسَنَةِ وَجَادَلْهُمْ بِالَّتِي يَحْيَ أَحْسَنَ.
It's not for,
it doesn't mean you have to call unto to the way of Allah Almighty, the path of Allah.
With wisdom.
With wisdom. In a very good manner, you discuss things.
You don't impose it.
وَالْحِكْمَةِ
وَالْمَوْعِزَةِ الْحَسَنَةِ.
I mean, you are advising, counseling, asking him to do something in a very polite and respectful way.
Right, it's like a bilateral relationship.
Yes, a dialogue. It's talking, maybe we think that this holy verse is talking about non-believers.
Hmm.
No, even it's talking about believers, your children. You need to talk to them, talk wisdom. What is wisdom? What is hikmah? Hikmah means it's a level where you achieve that that state where you can think what is the best way to do things.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you talk about, for example, when we talk about wisdom and hikmah in the Quran, we see that the Allah Almighty mentions Luqman.
Exactly.
That he gave him hikmah, wisdom, anishkur lillah. That he, with this wisdom, he's able to thank Allah Almighty.
Right. And this wisdom comes from pure worshipping of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, solely and purely for his sake. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, you brothers and sisters. Sayyid beautifully mentioned the point that as parents, we shouldn't impose our ideas onto our children. And as the beautiful verse of the Quran says, try to talk to people with wisdom and ma'izatil hasana, with a beautiful dialogue-ish way, not a monologue-ish way, right? And
wajadilhum bil-lati ahsan.
Right.
And argue with them in a very polite, in a beautiful way.
The most beautiful way.
The most beautiful way. Hikmah is doing things in the beautiful way. Hikmah, anishkur lillah, is something which leads you to thank Allah. Thanking Allah is not by just saying shukran lillah or alhamdulillah. It's doing things in the proper way. Using the bounties given to us by Allah Almighty, everything that has been given to us, all the resources which we have at our disposal have been given to us by Allah. Using them in a proper way, in the proper, the best way, with ihsan, carrying out good deeds with our bodies, with our souls, with our minds, it is according to hikmah. And this leads us to thank Allah Almighty in a practical way. Thanking is not just saying.
Lip service.
It's not only thinking about the fact that we thank Allah, or it's not even feeling for Him. Doing things in the best possible way with wisdom.
Living beautifully.
Exactly. This is what wisdom leads us to.
Right.
So we need to employ the best possible way to call others towards Islam.
Mm-hmm.
We want to call out the first and foremost people. Whom we want to call towards Islam. And as the Quran says, "Qu anfusakum wa ahlikum nara."
Right.
It's your children.
Right. If you want your children to grow up to become the imams of the society, to be the leaders of the society, it means that throughout the process of education, that when they're in your home and under your supervision, you bring them up to be strong believers of faith. And just the way that Allah instructs us to talk about followers of other faith, that, you know, jadilhum billati hiya ahsan, you have to use exactly the same technique with your own children.
Of course.
In transferring faith, iman, to your...
faith based on reasoning.
Right.
We don't want blind believers. We need people to have belief based on sound reasoning.
Right.
So we need to teach them to be able to be sound reasoners, whether it's in the realm of pure reasoning, whether it's in the realm of practical reasoning.
Right.
So we need to teach them and argue with them. So when we're indulging in this, when we're giving time to this, we need to be very careful. And all the time we are developing the way we reason with them. The arguments which we are presenting should be incremental. Every time we discuss with our children, they should be learning, whether for the child, whether for ourselves also.
Exactly. I just wanted to mention this point that oftentimes, We as parents need to empower ourselves first, because in this world with constant changes and challenges bombarding us from all directions, we need to strengthen our beliefs and we need to strengthen our reasoning, and we need to study, learn constantly, be in touch with the ulama, go to Islamic centers, you know, always be in a never-stopping process of learning. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Regarding the saying of Allah the Exalted, أنفسكم وأهليكم نارا, save yourselves and your family from a fire. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, teach yourselves and your family righteousness.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. We've been talking about the importance of talking logically to our children.
Yes, as you mentioned before the break, the very thing that is mentioned, utlubul ilma min al mahdi ila al-lahd, it's not talking about formal learning, is it?
No.
It's talking about informal ways of learning, and the very discussions and arguments which you have with other people, it's strengthening your own understanding, it's enhancing your understanding, so that is a continuous development of yourself and your child. It goes hand in hand. Every teacher, every guide learns more, in my opinion, learns more than the student.
Exactly. And as parents, when you're on your own, and if you're married, you don't have any children, you go in a monotonic way, you know, it's you, pretty much your spouse. But when you know that a little two eyes are watching you all the time, watches every move that you make, then you become really scared that, you know, what are you doing to that child? Which takes you back at how your thoughts are shaped, how your actions are teaching that little one. So parents, educate yourselves.
Exactly. So educate yourselves to be able to educate others, your children especially, because as a person who is a worthy, competent person, as a saleh person, of course, when you want to become an alim for a scholar or going to the society, you need to be a professional in doing so. But at home, you're not doing it as a profession. You're doing it as a duty, as a responsibility. You need to learn to manage things in the best possible way. So you need to develop yourself and your children and to become models for them. And the learning has to continue. The argument has to be there. The argument shouldn't be a monologue. It should be a continuous development of a thought process. It shouldn't lead to conflict. It shouldn't lead to anger. We should agree to disagree. There's no problem in that.
Right. I think the foundation of having a good discussion or argument with your child is this love that we mentioned before. If the bond between the parent and child is not established based on love, then even if you're a philosopher, even if you are the most educated and revered scholar in any part of the world, but if there is no love between you and your child, it will go nowhere.
Exactly. And mind you, you need to take care of his level also. قَلِّمِ النَّاسِ عَلَىٰ قَدْرِ قُولِهِمْ.
Right.
You can't philosophize in a way that he can't understand or she can't understand.
Right.
You need to, you know, tone down your arguments also.
According to your addressee.
Yeah, exactly. So that is important. So we need to learn that. And the fourth thing is that transformational parents are themselves inspired parents. They want to learn, they want to grow, they want to go forward. They're always motivated. They're people who are becoming productive. They are productive members of society. There's no retirement for them.
Right. They're always full of ideas, innovations, newer techniques, always ready to justify and modify their techniques. If anywhere they see that their way or their behavior is not working, they think of learning new ways to cooperate and establish that bond between their children.
Exactly. It's because they themselves are productive. They want to, they are inspired. They want to be productive members of society. Their children also. The most challenging thing is today that technology is such that previously we were looking at the TV screen. We thought that the TV screen is everything that is there in the world. Now we're looking at a smaller thing in our palms, and we think the whole world is here.
What's the next step?
I mean, it's something...
Chips inside them are our minds.
Of course. I mean, you have holograms coming up, people coming up from all over the thousands of miles away, and you're looking at the hologram of a person
who's talking. The virtual world.
Which, it's all there. I mean, but still it's a tunnel vision. We're not allowing ourselves to go out of it. Technology is not allowing that. That is the problem with technology. It's not allowing you to think out of the box.
Right.
So we need to provide alternatives to our children.
You know, they said that modernism came to teach people that they shouldn't necessarily let religion to fix their mentality, but modernity itself taught people to learn and to think in a fixed way. This brings us to the end of another episode of our program, Islamic Upbringing. Thank you so much. I hope that our discussions were fruitful for you and you learned new information and new points. If you guys have any questions, feel free to write to us to our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Thank you so much. Take care of your beautiful souls and goodbye.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
The conversation. Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we take you, the audience, back to October 12, 1984. In an event that shook the British establishment, a bomb detonated at the Grand Hotel in Brighton, England, killing five people and almost killing then-British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Our next guest was central to this IRA attack. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildenew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Pat McGee. Pat is a former member of the IRA who was jailed for the Brighton bombing in 1984. After serving 15 years, he was released under the Good Friday Agreement. Pat McGee, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sean.
Pat, before we begin, can you tell me a bit about your childhood growing up in Belfast?
Well, at the age of four, I actually left Belfast. The family moved to England. But my best memories of those years were up to the age of four. You know, very solid memories. I'm talking about, I can detail events that happened when I know I was only two. And I think growing up in England, I felt very alienated there. It wasn't a very happy childhood, I have to say that. But I was always thinking about what I'd left behind in my grandfather's house. And I think because I used to go back to it all the time in my head, it firmed up those memories. And they're among the most firm memories I have. And it was a happy time.
So, Pat, what age were you when you came back to Ireland? And you know, what were those years like, and what motivated you to join the IRA?
Well, the family used to return to Belfast on occasions, and family members from Belfast used to visit us. We were living in a place called Norwich in England. And so I had those links, you know, and they remain quite strong. I first returned on my own, onto my own volition, when I was 19, but only for a short while. But it was specifically to see what was happening. I was concerned about what was happening as it was portrayed in the media. You just knew that you weren't getting the full story. This is before events even kicked off properly, as we understand it. But I came back instead at 20. And
what year was that?
That would have been 19, just after internment, so 71.
Okay.
August 71, 15th of August. It was that Sunday, or that Saturday night, yeah. And again, it was that desire just to see what was happening on the ground. Just before, the week before, that whole week taken up by events and over internment, you were getting a feed in the papers, and they were terrible events, and they were getting covered more than perhaps later on the press dealt with these issues. But you still knew that you weren't getting the full account. I had an aunt living in Andytown who had a phone, and I remember talking to her, and she was able to tell me that it was that bad that they had to hide behind the settee. You know, this is a gun battle in the streets in Andytown. And so, you know, they weren't covering that in the news. Mm-hmm. And so I came back just to see for myself. And I guess over a period of time, I got to see what was happening, got a better understanding of it. I would have been kind of, for example, I'd known guys, contemporaries, who would have joined the British Army. And at that stage, I would have never have thought of them as Brits or had a bad view of them. But you're hearing all these accounts of what they were doing to people in the streets, you know, the abuse of people. And I couldn't square that with what I knew. Well, you see that for yourself. You're a witness to it. And I saw how people dealt with this occupation. You know, the constant raids. And our house was raided. The messing about in the streets, etc. Just general abuse you felt in your home was occupied. Mm-hmm. And yet that community, it was a Carrickhill community, them days it was Unity Flats, you saw how they coped. And they were all doing it. Everybody seemed to me to be connected. And I just wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to be included in that. Didn't know what I could do, what my contribution could be. Really did not know. But I at least wanted to contribute in some way. Eventually that caused me to join the IRA.
When you joined the IRA, what year was that, Pat?
1972.
1972. So the year of Bloody Sunday was the beginning, January 72. And did the likes of Bloody Sunday, was that something that motivated you, or was it what you were seeing on the streets in Belfast?
More the latter. Just an accumulation. I mean, there was no big, you know, event. And that there were many big events, but no, it was an accumulation. What was happening, the daily grind, and seeing how people locally cope with that and wanting to be a part of it.
And of course, just moving on a bit, and we're going to start talking about the Brighton bomb in 1984. Can you tell me a bit about that, how you got involved in that?
Well, during internment, I was interned from 73 to 75. A lot of time to think. And how, again, it's just about what can I do? And I recognised that effectively the best we could do was to target England. Effectively, our actions, you know, with the little resources available to us, would count more there. And I thought, well, I've got a head start here. I was brought up in that. There's a lot of people around me, young lads, but I'm talking about jail, you know, internment. They've never been out of Belfast or never been out of there, you know, where they're from in the country. I had at least that. It seemed to me that put me at some sort of an advantage, you know. And so I came out of internment with a very firm view and commitment to somehow, you know, volunteer to be part of the English campaign. And I suppose the next period was achieving that end. And so eventually I was active in England. And it was seen as a campaign, Brighton, the Brighton operation, for all of its importance in terms of its targeting, was part of a campaign. We believed that the only way to get the Brits to the negotiating table was for a sustained campaign. Not one operation, no matter how significant, could achieve that. It was about getting a long-term, you know, attack in England. And I think eventually we did that, after a lot of stops and starts, and I wasn't part of that. I was in jail by that stage. We'd have operated in England, withdrew because of logistics involved, and then come back to it. That wasn't a plan, the sort of pressure that was going to be needed. It took us a long time for the movement to gain what was needed. And eventually it did.
Pat, I suppose we know that the people who were operating in England or in Britain at all, there were sometimes greater risks, and certainly the way they were treated after arrest and all the rest was seemed to be pretty brutal. And I'm thinking of people like L. O'Dwyer and Martin Anderson, the Balcombe Street men. You know, there seemed to be a certain level of brutality against Irish prisoners in Britain, and innocent or not, they were all treated really badly, weren't they? What?
It's not quite as straightforward as that, because it was a long campaign, a long history of our people in jail in England. The real harsh days, or the early days, where it was brutal was the norm. Gradually, I think we got on top of it to the point where we were respected by screws and prisoners alike, and you know, we established ourselves. But and you mentioned Ella and Martina, their treatment was atrocious.
Absolutely.
As two women isolated. They've got a harsher, much harsher regime in terms of strip searches, etc., general messing about, than any male prisoner, never mind whether Republican or otherwise. It was brutal.
So just bringing it back to the Brighton bomb in itself, can you tell me about your role in the Brighton bomb?
No, I can't really, but I don't want to. I don't want to talk about the specifics of the operation. It's just fair to say, like, that I was the person central, you know, he planted the device. But beyond that, I won't comment on it.
And will you tell us about your arrest then and what happened after the bomb?
Well, I was arrested in Glasgow on another operation about 9 months later. And basically walked into a sort of a trap. Somebody else has been followed. I met them and became, it was in the net, so to speak, and we led them to the rest of the people we were working with. And that's how I was arrested, June 85.
You're still tuned in to The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. Michelle Gildenry, my co-host, is here, alongside our special guest, human rights advocate Pat McGee. You just spoke about your time in prison, and you'd mentioned about L. O'Dwyer and Martin Anderson, about the how they'd got it an awful lot worse than the male prisoners. Tell me, what was it like in jail in England? Because I know that you were then moved as part of the circumstances, you were moved to the north. Tell us just a bit more about your own treatment in jail.
Well, once you get through the year on remand, and you're so taken up with the upcoming trial that all your thoughts are about that, so you don't really, you know, everything else bounces off you, you know what I mean by that. But then you're transferred, you know, the place you're going to be in for the rest of your life if they have their way. I was put in what's called a special secure unit. These were special units. They've been likened to prisons within prisons because of the security involved, but there would only be, say, 7 prisoners. And it would be the same 7 prisoners kept there for quite a number of years, very little coming or going. And there would be, everything was isolated from the rest of the prison population. And the screw contingent, they would be specific for the unit. So it's very claustrophobic, you feel isolated. And I think there's good cause to think that we all were damaged by it. I mean that, I felt it myself. There was times when I verged on a breakdown. I was that close to it. I felt it, you know. But I ended up spending 4 years in two units, so 8 years in total in the units, before our transfer was what they call a transfer, we call it repatriation. A bit of a slip there. before my patriation, our patriation to back home. And our families have been campaigning for that for a long time. This has got to be borne in mind, even though we were there in prison, our whole families and our communities were affected by this. The terrible plight of your loved ones having to get the meagre means together to come across twice a year, say, to see you. We'd accumulated our visits. We couldn't do it on a weekly basis. But so they pooled their visits and came over about twice a year, school holidays maybe, and at Christmas. So it was really tough on families, you know. I was transferred the day after the ceasefire declaration in 31st of August, 94. The very next day. In fact, we had won a concession in the jail. We were looking for sort of contact, coverage, RTE coverage, and we got it. We got RTE coverage. And so we were able to see the declaration and, the cavalcade with the flags out in Belfast. There, it was. We felt part of that, actually felt part of it. It was a jubilant moment, you know, a corner had been turned, and highly significant. And just after that, and I mean within minutes, a screw came into the room and says, Pat and a couple of others says, get your bags packed, you know, you're going home. Can you imagine how stunning that was? Mm-hmm. And we all celebrated with a sing-song out our cell windows that night, and then the next morning we were huge security transferred to Hull Airport, put on a specially commandeered plane, handcuffed, huge security presence on the plane, brought to Belfast International, the old Aldergrove, transferred a single prison van, all of us, and brought to the prison. You couldn't believe the difference, you know.
How many of you were in the van? And
three of us, and then a couple of screws, probably three screws. But it was all very low-key. I mean, as far as we were concerned, you know, we were going home. We were a step nearer home. In terms of the negotiations, we know what was going on. Things were moving ahead. But also that just we were amongst our own. Even though there were screws, you were hearing Irish accents for the first time, you know, when we were just submerged in all this Englishness, you know.
That must have been very special. And when, so the negotiations were going on, when did you sort of feel or hear the first moves of, you know, the settlement and the Good Friday Agreement and the work that was ongoing towards that and the moves towards?
Not so much here as what you know about what was happening in our present state at any given time. Standing in the dock, I knew we were good. Things are going in our direction. So, you know, the political development of Sinn Féin, etc., and the mounted campaign, things were more positive at that moment. And within a year of that, you know, the political developments, and that continued. So it was going to go there, but we still knew we had to kind of knuckle down and get through the sentence. Mm-hmm. I estimated that, this is just me, this is my peculiar way of looking at things, I thought there'd be a focus on a political solution before the new millennium. I thought that would concentrate their minds. We know it happened well before that. Mm-hmm. But that was my time scale of what I thought I had to cope with personally. Yeah. You know, so you're geared to that.
So you were gearing up for the remainder of your sentence here. Mm-hmm. You were amongst your own people. Your family, it was easier for your family to visit. You didn't feel the same sense of isolation. But then you were released under the Good Friday Agreement. So how did that feel? Or
the run-up to that, we started a veil of the conditions that apply to all the prisoners. We were held under, still held under a Home Office rules, which meant we didn't get the entitlement that other prisoners had to pre-release schemes, etc. Then suddenly, that was conceded to us, and I must have got out like about 100 days or something. That was spread out before, so that's kind of a preparation for it. It wasn't suddenly you're out. I was in, I think it was 12 years and 4 months, and suddenly I'm outside of prison. It's a huge moment, you know. But on the 14th anniversary of my capture, I was released. You know, I was released. So it took place in December 2000.
And Pat, you struck up this extraordinary relationship with Joe Barry, whose father was killed in the Brighton bomb. Do you want to speak a bit about that and how that came about?
Well, I met Joe Barry that first time in November 2000. I thought it was going to be a one-off meeting. I was there, in a sense, wearing a political hat. I would try to explain to Joe, this woman, why we targeted Brighton, to put that operation in a context and hopefully do it with some sensitivity. And that conversation became a conversation, lasted 3 hours. And it was a very incredible and tense experience for both of us, I'm sure. And it was an exchange. I was, again, explaining our motivations and the context of the day. She was telling me things about her own experiences of her father and of the impact of the bomb on her and her family. And clearly a very sound, intelligent woman who knew quite a bit about Ireland. In fact, had visited Belfast quite soon, within a couple of years, of her father's death, wanting to know. I was completely unaware of this. I only got to hear about this, as I said, a matter of months beforehand. But this is something she was committed to achieving long before that, right from the loss of her father. And, as I'm saying, you're gauging this woman, and at some stage she recited a poem she'd written, and she'd written this sometime between 3 and 6 months before actually meeting me, before we were in this room sitting talking. And there was a phrase in the poem, "Now I stand before you who killed my father." She had actually prefigured the moment, and it was really affecting, and it was like a completely different conversation after that. And as I said, I'm getting some impression of this woman. She's a very fine woman, and then suddenly something just clicked. It's what I perceived in her, knew, must have, in some measure, coming from this man. It had come from him. She was clearly. The loss was apparent. And I killed this guy, In other words, I killed a fine human being. And for me, it changed things. I couldn't articulate this feeling in the moment. But after that first meeting, I had all these thoughts, and tried to put them down on paper too, how to take this forward. I never for a moment thought there would be a second meeting, but I would have jumped at a second meeting. What I didn't appreciate was that Joe wanted the same. She wanted to meet me again. She also had this feeling that was more to be said, more to be explored. And the next meeting occurred 2 weeks later. And we've been meeting quite regularly since then.
Pat, it's been an extraordinary journey. And me and you have become good friends over this last number of years. And it's always good to have you here. I want to thank you, okay? I want to thank Michelle. And you're welcome back any time. It'd be great to see you again.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks, William.
This week we take a look at Bloody Sunday and the reverberations that followed for many years after. How has the city of Derry moved on from then, or can it ever fully?
که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Subjects on divine issues and mythical issues are easy, and each person thinks he has understood them. After the rise of logical reasoning and following it, reaching the inferences of these subjects and the results of the logical reasoning to the heart, which is called faith, is more difficult. This subject must reach the heart with prompting, repetitions, and self-abstinence. You notice that as necessitated, a deceased person does not inflict any loss to a person except some persons. Others, if they are alone in a graveyard and they are confronted with the body of a dead person in a mortuary, they are overcome with fear. This is because the logical reasoning and mental necessity has not reached the heart.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And the subject of the Islamic revolution, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh said, "We brought a novel experience. We adopted democracy from religion. Our democracy is accompanied by spirituality and religion. Hence, it became religious popular rule. It became the Islamic Republic." One of the factors for the Iranian people's uprising against the regime of Mohammad Reza, it became the Islamic Republic. Well, this sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh is about the nobleness of the revolution in Iran. The regime of Shah was opposite to Islamic culture and values and tried to promote morality in society. The Islamic Revolution put an end to this evil situation, and the promotion and propagation of religion replaced it.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi.
The religiosity and spirituality of the revolution is so important that Ayatollah Khamenei Hafizahullah said, "The message of the Islamic revolution is the message of spirituality, attention to spirituality, and bringing the elements of spirituality in human life, and heeding of morality and God." During 4 decades, ample activities have been done for expansion of the Islamic culture. Mosques have played such an important role in this regard that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh called mosques as the trenches of the revolution. The quantity and quality of religious ceremonies have increased as well. The morning ceremonies of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and other imams of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam are held very gloriously and fervently. Along with that, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, many efforts have been made to promote lofty teachings of the Holy Book of Quran across the country. Presently, 11,000 institutions related with Quran are active in cities and villages, offering a variety of Quranic teachings to different age groups. Moreover, 35 rounds of international competitions of Quran have been held in Iran in different fields. These competitions are considered the most valid and important Quranic events in the world. And that is why Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh focused on this issue and introduced the nobleness of the revolution in Iran as one of its main characteristics. May Allah bless his soul.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Khomeini, Khomeini, Khomeini,
every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say la ilaha
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran, and different commentary points of these verses.
Brothers and sisters, we have reached the 63rd verse of chapter Nur. Now let's listen to the 63rd verse of Surah An-Nur.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. La taj'alu du'aa